just like every day. XVIII. High Prince of War. Eti was once a kind and generous man, and you saw what became of him. Race, on the other hand, was among the most loathsome, crafty, and dangerous individuals I had ever met.
"Yeah, this was cut,"
the portly leather worker said, holding up the straps as Adolin watched.
"Wouldn't you agree, yes?"
The other leather worker nodded. Yis was a yellow-eyed Iriali with stark golden hair. Not blonde, golden. There was even a metallic sheen to it. He kept it short and wore a cap. Obviously, he didn't want to draw attention to it. Many considered a lock of Iriali hair to be a ward of good luck. His companion, Avaran, was in a lethe dark eyes who wore an apron over his vest. If the two men worked in the traditional way, one would labor on the larger, more robust pieces, like saddles, while the other specialized in fine detail. A group of apprentices toiled in the background, cutting or sewing hogshide.
"Sliced,"
Yis agreed, taking the straps from Avaran.
"I concur."
"Well, I meet a damnation," Adolin muttered. "You mean Elikar was actually right?" "Adolin," a feminine voice said from behind, "you said we'd be going on a walk." "That's what we're doing," he said, turning to smile. Yanala stood with arms folded, wearing a sleek yellow dress of impeccable fashion, buttoning up the sides, cupping around the neck with a stiff collar embroidered with crimson thread. "I had imagined," she said, "that a walk would involve more walking."
"Hmm," he said. "Yes, we'll be getting right to that soon. It'll be grand. Lots of prancing, sauntering, and,
promenading?"
Yes, the leather worker offered. "Isn't that a type of drink?" Adolin asked.
No, Bright Lord. I'm fairly certain it's another word for walking."
"Well then," Adolin said, "we'll do plenty of it too. Promenading. I always love a good promenading." He rubbed his chin, taking the strap back. "How certain are you about this strap?"
"There's really no room for question, Bright Lord," Avaran said. "That's not a simple tear. You should be more careful."
"Careful?"
"Yes," Avaran said. "Make sure that no loose buckles are scraping the leather, cutting into it. This looks like it came from a saddle. Sometimes people let the girth straps hang down when setting the saddle for the night, and they get pinched underneath something. I'd guess that caused the slice."
"Oh," Adolin said. "You mean it wasn't cut intentionally?"
"Well, it could have been that," Avaran said. "But why would someone cut a girth like this?"
Why indeed, Adolin thought. He bid farewell to the two leather workers, tucked the strap into his pocket, then held out his elbow to Yanala. She took it with her free hand, obviously happy to finally be free of the leatherworking shop. It had a faint odor about it, though not nearly as bad as a tannery. He'd seen her reaching for her handkerchief a few times, acting as if she wanted to hold it up to her nose. They stepped out into the midday sunlight. Tybin and Marks, two light-eyed members of the Cobalt Guard, waited outside with Yanala's handmaiden Falksy, who was a young Azish Dark Eyes. The three fell into step behind Adolin and Yanala as they walked out onto the street of the war camp, Falksy muttering under her breath in an accented voice about the lack of a proper palanquin for her mistress. Yanala didn't seem to mind. She breathed deeply of the open air and clung to his arm. She was quite beautiful, even if she did like to talk about herself. Talkativeness was normally an attribute he was fond of in a woman. But today he had trouble paying attention as Yanala began telling him about the latest court gossip. The strap had been cut, but the leather workers had both assumed that it was the result of an accident. That implied they'd seen cuts like this before. A loose buckle or other mishap slicing the leather. Except this time, that cut had thrown the king in the middle of a fight. Could there be something to it?
Wouldn't you say, Adolin?
Inala asked.
Undoubtedly, he said, listening with half an ear. So you'll talk to him?
Hmm?
Your father. You'll ask him about letting the men abandon that dreadfully unfashionable uniform once in a while.
Well, he's rather set on the idea, Adolin said. Besides, it's really not that unfashionable.
Inala gave him a flat stare.
All right, he admitted, it is a little drab. Like every other high-ranked light-eyed officer in Dalinar's army, Adolin wore a simple blue outfit of militaristic cut, a long coat of solid blue, no embroidery, and stiff trousers in a time when vests, silk accents, and scarves were the fashion. His father's Colin glyph pair was emblazoned quite obtrusively on the back and breast, and the front fastened with silver buttons up both sides. It was simple, distinctly recognizable, but awfully plain.
Your father's men love him, Adolin, Inala said, but his requirements are growing tiresome.
I know, trust me, but I don't think I can change his mind. How to explain? Despite 6 years at war, Dalinar wasn't weakening in his resolve to hold to the codes. If anything, his dedication to them was strengthening. At least now, Adolin understood somewhat. Dalinar's beloved brother had made one last request. Follow the codes. True, that request had been in reference to a single event, but Adolin's father was known to take things to extremes. Adolin just wished he wouldn't make the same requirement of everyone else. Individually, the codes were only minor inconveniences. Always be in uniform when in public, never be drunken, avoid dueling. In aggregate, however, they were burdensome. His response to Inala was cut off as a set of horns blared through the camp. Adolin perked up, spinning, looking eastward toward the shattered plains. He counted off the next series of horns. A chrysalis had been spotted on Plateau 147. That was within striking distance. He held his breath, waiting for a third series of horns to blare, calling Dalinar's armies to battle. That would only happen if his father ordered it. Part of him knew those horns wouldn't come. 147 was close enough to Satius's war camp that the other High Prince would certainly try for it.
Come on, father, Adolin thought. We can race him for it.
No horns came. Adolin glanced at Inala. She'd chosen music as her calling and paid little attention to the war, though her father was one of Dalinar's cavalry officers. From her expression, Adolin could tell that even she understood what the lack of a third horn meant. Once again, Dalinar Colin had chosen not to fight. Come on, Adolin said, turning and moving in another direction, practically towing Inala along by her elbow. There's something else I want to check into. Dalinar stood with hands clasped behind his back, looking out over the shattered plains. He was on one of the lower terraces outside Elokar's elevated palace. The king didn't reside in one of the 10 war camps, but in a small compound, elevated along a hillside nearby. Dalinar's climb to the palace had been interrupted by the horns. He stood long enough to see Satius's army gathering inside his camp. Dalinar could have sent a soldier to prepare his own men. He was close enough.
Bright Lord, a voice asked from the side. Do you wish to continue?
You protect him your way, Satius, Dalinar thought. I'll protect him my way. Yes, Teshuv, he said, turning to continue walking up the switchbacks. Teshuv joined him. She had streaks of blonde in her otherwise black Alethi hair, which she wore up in an intricate crossing weave. She had violet eyes, and her pinched face bore a concerned expression. That was normal. She always seemed to need something to worry about. Teshuv and her attendant scribe were both wives of his officers. Dalinar trusted them. Mostly. It was hard to trust anyone completely.
Stop it, he thought. You're starting to sound as paranoid as the king.
Regardless, he'd be very glad for Yasna's return. if she ever decided to return. Some of his higher officers hinted to him that he should marry again, if only to have a woman who could be his primary scribe. They thought he rejected their suggestions because of love for his first wife. They didn't know that she was gone, vanished from his mind, a blank patch of fog in his memory. Though in a way, his officers were right. He hesitated to remarry because he hated the idea of replacing her. He'd had everything of his wife taken from him. All that remained was the hole, and filling it to gain a scribe seemed callous. Dalinar continued on his way. Other than the two women, he was attended by Renarin and three members of the Cobalt Guard. The latter wore deep blue felt caps and cloaks over silvery breastplates and deep blue trousers. They were light eyes of low rank, able to carry swords for close fighting.
"Well, Bright Lord," Teshuv said. "Bright Lord Adolin asked me to report the progress of the saddle girth investigation. He's speaking with leatherworkers at this very moment, but so far there is very little to say. Nobody witnessed anyone interfering with the saddle or His Majesty's horse. Our spies say there are no whispers of anyone in the other war camps bragging, and nobody in our camp has suddenly received large sums of money, so far as we've discovered."
"The grooms?"
"Say they checked over the saddle," she said, "but when pressed, they admit that they can't specifically remember checking the girth."
She shook her head.
"Carrying a shardbearer places great strain on both horse and saddle. If there were only some way to tame more Rashadium."
"I think you'll sooner tame the high storms, Brightness." "Well, this is good news, I suppose. Better for us all that this strap business turns out to be nothing. Now, there is another item I wish you to look into."
"It is my pleasure to serve, Bright Lord."
"High Prince Aladar has begun to talk of taking a short vacation back to Alethkar. I want to know if he's serious."
"Yes, Bright Lord," Teshuv nodded. "Would that be a problem?"
"I'm honestly not sure. He didn't trust the High Princes, but at least with them all here, he could watch them. If one of them returned to Alethkar, the man could scheme unchecked. Of course, even brief visits might help stabilize their homeland."
"Which was more important, stability or the ability to watch over the others?"
"Blood of my fathers," he thought. "I wasn't made for this politicking and scheming. I was made to wield a sword and ride down enemies." He'd do what needed to be done anyway. "I believe you said you had information on the king's accounts, Teshuv?"
"Indeed," she said, as they continued the short hike. "You were correct to have me look into the ledgers, as it appears that three of the High Princes, Thanadol, Hatham, and Vama, are well behind in their payments. Other than yourself, only High Prince Sadius has actually paid ahead on what is owed, as the tenets of war require."
Dalinar nodded. "The longer this war stretches, the more comfortable the High Princes are getting. They're starting to question. Why pay high wartime rates for soul casting? Why not move farmers out here and start growing their own food?"
"Pardon, Bright Lord," Teshuv said as they turned around to switch back.
Her attendant scribe walked behind, several ledgers clipped to boards carried in a satchel.
"But do we really wish to discourage that? A second stream of supplies could be valuable as a redundancy."
"The merchants already provide redundancy," Dalinar said, "which is one of the reasons I haven't chased them off. I wouldn't mind another, but the soulcasters are the only hold we have on the High Princes. They owed Gavilar loyalty, but they feel little of that for his son." Dalinar narrowed his eyes. "This is a vital point, Teshuv. Have you read the histories I suggested?"
"Yes, Bright Lord."
"Then you know. The most fragile period in a kingdom's existence comes during the lifetime of its founder's heir. During the reign of a man like Gavilar, men stay loyal because of their respect for him. During subsequent generations, men begin to see themselves as part of a kingdom, a united force that holds together because of tradition. But the son's reign, that's the dangerous point. Gavilar isn't here to hold everyone together, but there isn't yet a tradition of Alethkar being a kingdom. We've got to carry on long enough for the High Princes to begin seeing themselves as part of a greater whole."
Yes, Bright Lord.
She didn't question. Teshuv was deeply loyal to him, as were most of his officers. They didn't question why it was so important to him that the Ten Princedoms regard themselves as one nation. Perhaps they assumed it was because of Gavilar. Indeed, his brother's dream of a united Alethkar was part of it. There was something else, though.
The Everstorm comes. The true desolation. The Night of Sorrows.
He suppressed a shiver. The visions certainly didn't make it sound like he had a great deal of time to prepare.
Draft a missive in the king's name, Dalinar said, decreasing soul-casting costs for those who have made their payments on time. That should wake up the others. Give it to Elikar's scribes and have them explain it to him. Hopefully he will agree with the need.
Yes, Bright Lord, Teshuv said. If I might note, I was quite surprised that you suggested I read those histories. In the past, such things haven't been particular to your interests.
I do a lot of things lately that aren't particular to my interests or my talents, Dalinar said with a grimace. My lack of capacity doesn't change the kingdom's needs. Have you gathered reports of banditry in the area?
Yes, Bright Lord.
She hesitated.
The rates are quite alarming.
Tell your husband I give him command of the 4th Battalion, Dalinar said. I want the two of you to work out a better pattern of patrol in the unclaimed hills. So long as the Alethi monarchy has a presence here, I do not want it to be a land of lawlessness.
Yes, Bright Lord, Teshuv said, sounding hesitant. You realize that means you've committed 2 entire battalions to patrolling?
Yes, Dalinar said. He had asked for help from the other High Princes. Their reactions had ranged from shock to mirth. None had given him any soldiers.
That is added to the battalion you assigned to peacekeeping in the areas between war camps and the exterior merchant markets, Teshuv added. In total, that's over 1/4 of your forces here, Bright Lord.
The orders stand, Teshuv, he said. See to it. But first I have more to discuss with you regarding the ledgers. Go on ahead to the ledger room and wait for us there. She nodded respect.
Of course, Bright Lord.
She withdrew with her ward. Renarin stepped up to Dalinar.
She wasn't pleased about that, Father.
She wishes her husband to be fighting, Dalinar said. They all hope that I'll win another shard blade out there, then give it to them.
The Parshendi had shards. Not many, but even a single one was surprising. Nobody had an explanation for where they'd gotten them. Dalinar had won a Parshendi shard blade and plate during his first year here. He'd given both to Elikar, to award to a warrior he felt would be the most useful to Alethkar and the war effort. Dalinar turned and entered the palace proper. The guards at the doorway saluted him and Renarin. The young man kept his eyes forward, staring at nothing. Some people thought him emotionless, but Dalinar knew he was just preoccupied.
I've been meaning to speak with you, son, Dalinar said, about the hunt last week.
Renarin's eyes flickered downward in shame, the edges of his mouth pulling back in a grimace. Yes, he did have emotions. He just didn't show them as often as others.
You realize that you shouldn't have rushed into battle as you did, Dalinar said sternly. That chasm fiend could have killed you.
What would you have done, Father, if it had been me in danger?
I don't fault your bravery. I fault your wisdom. What if you'd had one of your fits?
Then perhaps the monster would have swept me off the plateau, Renarin said bitterly. And I would no longer be such a useless drain on everyone's time.
Don't say such things. Not even in jest.
Was it jest? Father, I can't fight.
Fighting is not the only thing of value a man can do.
The Ardens were very specific about that. Yes, the highest calling of men was to join the battle in the afterlife, but the Almighty accepted the excellence of any man or woman, regardless of what they did. You just did your best, picking a profession and an attribute of the Almighty to emulate. A calling and a glory, it was said. You worked hard at your profession, and you spent your life trying to live according to a single ideal. The Almighty would accept that, particularly if you were light-eyed. The better your blood is a light eyes, the more innate glory you had already. Dalinar's calling was to be a leader, and his chosen glory was determination. He'd chosen both in his youth, though he now viewed them very differently than he once had.
"You are right, of course, father," Renarin said. "I am not the first hero's son to be born without any talent for warfare. The others all got along. So shall I. Likely I will end up as city lord of a small town, assuming I don't tuck myself away in the devotaries." The boy's eyes turned forward.
"I still think of him as the boy," Dalinar thought, "even though he's now in his 20th year." Wit had been right. Dalinar underestimated Renarin. "How would I react if I were forbidden to fight, kept back with the women and the merchants?" Dalinar would have been bitter, particularly against Adolin. In fact, Dalinar had often been envious of Gavilar during their boyhood. Renarin, however, was Adolin's greatest supporter. He all but worshipped his elder brother. And he was brave enough to dash heedless into the middle of a battlefield where a nightmare creature was smashing spearmen and tossing aside shard-bearers. Dalinar cleared his throat.
"Perhaps it is time to again try training you in the sword."
"My blood weakness
won't matter a bit if we get you into a set of plate and give you a blade," Dalinar said. "The armor makes any man strong, and a shard blade is nearly as light as air itself."
"Father," Renarin said flatly, "I'll never be a shard bearer. You yourself have said that the blades and plate we win from the Parshendi must go to the most skilled warriors."
"None of the other high princes give up their spoils to the king," Dalinar said. "And who would fault me if for once I made a gift to my son?"
Renarin stopped in the hallway, displaying an unusual level of emotion, eyes opening wider, face eager.
"You are serious?"
"I give you my oath, son. If I can capture another blade and plate, they will go to you."
He smiled.
"To be honest, I'd do it simply for the joy of seeing Sadius's face when you become a full shard bearer. Beyond that, if your strength is made equal to others, I expect that your natural skill will make you shine."
Renarin smiled. Shardplate wouldn't solve everything, but Renarin would have his chance. Dalinar would see to it.
"I know what it's like to be a second son," he thought as they continued walking toward the king's chambers. "Overshadowed by an older brother you love, yet envy at the same time. Stormfather, but I do. I still feel that way."
"Ah, good bright Lord Adolin," the Arden said, walking forward with open arms.
Kaddish was a tall man in his later years, and wore the shaved head and square beard of his calling. He also had a twisting scar that ran around the top of his head, a memento from his earlier days as an army officer. It was uncommon to find a man such as him, a Light-Eyes who had once been a soldier, in the Ardentia. In fact, it was odd for any man to change his calling. But it wasn't forbidden, and Kaddish had risen far in the Ardentia considering his late start. Dalinar said it was a sign of either faith or perseverance. Perhaps both. The Warcamp's temple had started as a large soul-cast dome, then Dalinar had granted money and stonemasons to transform it into a more suitable house of worship. Carvings of the heralds now lined the inside walls, and broad windows carved on the leeward side had been set with glass to let in the light. Diamond spheres blazed in bunches hung from the high ceiling, and stands had been set up for the instruction, practice, and testing of the various arts. Many women were in at the moment, receiving instruction from the Ardens. There were fewer men. Being at war, it was easy to practice the masculine arts in the field. Yanala folded her arms, scanning the temple with obvious dissatisfaction as she stood beside Adolin.
"First a stinky leatherworker's shop, now the temple? I had assumed we would walk someplace at least faintly romantic."
"Religion's romantic," Adolin said, scratching his head. "Eternal love and all that, right?"
She eyed him. "I'm going to wait outside."
She turned and walked out with her handmaiden. And someone get me a storming palanquin. Adolin frowned, watching her go.
I'll have to buy her something quite expensive to make up for this, I suspect.
I don't see what the problem is, Kaddish said. I think religion is romantic.
You're an ardent, Adolin said flatly. Besides, that scar makes you a little too unsightly for my tastes. He sighed. It's not so much the temple that has set her off, but my lack of attention. I haven't been a very good companion today.
You have matters pressing upon your mind, Bright One? Kaddish asked. Is this about your calling? You haven't made much progress lately.
Adolin grimaced. His chosen calling was dueling. By working with the Ardents to make personal goals and fulfill them, he could prove himself to the Almighty. Unfortunately, during war, the codes said Adolin was supposed to limit his duels, as frivolous dueling could wound officers who might be needed in battle. But Adolin's father avoided battle more and more. So what was the point of not dueling?
Holy One, Adolin said, we need to speak somewhere where we can't be overheard.
Kaddish raised an eyebrow and led Adolin around the central apex. Boren temples were always circular, with a gently sloping mound at the center, by custom rising 10 feet high. The building was dedicated to the Almighty, maintained by Dalinar and the Ardents he owned. All devotaries were welcome to use it, though most would have their own chapter houses in one of the war camps.
What is it you wish to ask of me, Bright One?
The Ardent asked, once they reached a more secluded section of the vast chamber. Kaddish was deferential, though he had tutored and trained Adolin during his childhood.
Is my father going mad? Adolin asked. Or could he really be seeing visions sent by the Almighty as I think he believes?
That's rather a blunt question.
You've known him longer than most, Kaddish. And I know you to be loyal. I also know you to be one who keeps his ears open and notices things, so I'm sure you've heard the rumors.
Adolin shrugged. Seems like a time for bluntness if there ever was one.
I take it then the rumors are not unfounded?
Unfortunately, no. It happens during every high storm. He raves and thrashes about and afterward claims to have seen things.
What sorts of things?
I'm not certain precisely, Adolin grimaced. Things about the Radiance, and perhaps about what is to come.
Kaddish looked disturbed.
This is dangerous territory, Bright One. What you are asking me about risks tempting me to violate my oaths. I am an Ardent, owned by and loyal to your father.
But he is not your religious superior.
No, but he is the Almighty's guardian of this people, set to watch me and make certain I don't rise above my station.
Kaddish pursed his lips.
It is a delicate balance we walk, Bright One. Do you know much of the hierocracy, the war of loss?
The church tried to seize control, Adolin said, shrugging. The priests tried to conquer the world, for its own good, they claimed.
That was part of it, Kaddish said. The part we speak of most often. But the problem goes much deeper. The church back then, it clung to knowledge. Men were not in command of their own religious paths. The priests controlled the doctrine, and few members of the church were allowed to know theology. They were taught to follow the priests, not the Almighty or the heralds, but the priests.
He began walking, leading Adolin around the back rim of the temple chamber. They passed statues of the heralds, 5 male, 5 female. In truth, Adolin knew very little of what Kaddish was saying. He'd never had much of a mind for history that didn't relate directly to the command of armies.
The problem, Bright One, Kaddish said, was mysticism. The priests claimed that common men could not understand religion or the Almighty. Where there should have been openness, there was smoke and whispers. The priests began to claim visions and prophecies, though such things had been denounced by the heralds themselves. Void binding is a dark and evil thing, and the soul of it was to try to divine the future. Adolin froze. Wait, you're saying... Don't get ahead of me, please, Bright One, Kaddish assured, turning back toward him. When the priests of the hierocracy were cast down, the Sunmaker made a point of interrogating them and going through their correspondences with one another. It was discovered that there had been no prophecies, no mystical promises from the Almighty. That had all been an excuse, fabricated by the priests to placate and control the people.
Adolin frowned. Where are you going with this, Kaddish?
As close as I dare to the truth, Bright One, the Arden said, as I cannot be as blunt as you.
You think my father's visions are fabrications, then?
I would never accuse my High Prince of lying, Kaddish said, or even of feebleness. But neither can I condone mysticism or prophecy in any form. To do so would be to deny Voronism. The days of the priests are gone. The days of lying to the people, of keeping them in darkness, are gone. Now each man chooses his own path, and the Ardens help him achieve closeness to the Almighty through it. Instead of shadowed prophecies and pretend powers held by a few, we have a population who understand their beliefs and their relationship with their God.
He stepped closer, speaking very softly.
Your father is not to be mocked or diminished. If his visions are true, then it is between him and the Almighty. All I can say is this. I know something of what it is to be haunted by the death and destruction of war. I see in your father's eyes much of what I have felt, but worse. My personal opinion is that the things he sees are likely more a reflection of his past than any mystical experience.
So he is going mad, Adolin whispered.
I did not say that.
You implied that the Almighty probably wouldn't send visions like these.
I did.
And that his visions are a product of his own mind.
Likely so, the Arden said, raising his finger. A delicate balance, you see. One that is particularly difficult to keep when speaking to my High Prince's own son.
He reached out, taking Adolin's arm.
If any are to help him, it must be you. It would not be the place of any other, even myself.
Adolin nodded slowly. Thank you.
You should likely go see to that young woman now.
Yes, Adolin said with a sigh. I fear that even with the right gift, she and I are not long for courting. Renarin will mock me again. Kaddish smiled.
Best not to give up so easily, Bright One. Go now. But do return sometime so we can speak of your goals in regard to your calling. It has been too long since you've elevated.
Adolin nodded and hurried from the chamber. After hours going over the ledgers with Teshuv, Dalinar and Renarin reached the hallway before the king's chambers. They walked in silence, the soles of their boots clapping the marble flooring, the sound echoing against stone walls. The corridors of the king's war palace were growing richer by the week. Once this hallway had been just another soul-cast stone tunnel. As Elokar settled in, he had ordered improvements. Windows were cut into the leeward side. Marble tiling was set into the floor. The walls were carved with reliefs, with mosaic trim at the corners. Dalinar and Renarin passed a group of stonemasons, carefully cutting a scene of Nalan Elin, emitting sunlight, the sword of retribution held over his head. They reached the king's antechamber, a large, open room guarded by 10 members of the king's guard, dressed in blue and gold. Dalinar recognized each face. He had personally organized the unit, hand-picking its members. High Prince Ruthar waited to see the king. He had brawny arms folded in front of him and wore a short black beard that surrounded his mouth. The red silk coat was cut short and did not button. Almost more of a sleeved vest, it was a mere token nod to traditional Alethi uniform. The shirt underneath was ruffled and white, and his blue trousers were loose with wide cuffs. Ruthar glanced Dalinar's way and nodded to him, a minor token of respect, then turned to chat with one of his attendants. He cut off, however, as the guards at the doorway stepped aside to let Dalinar enter. Ruthar sniffed in annoyance. Dalinar's easy access to the king galled the other high princes. The king wasn't in his wardroom, but the wide doors to his balcony were open. Dalinar's guardsmen waited behind as he stepped out onto the balcony, Renarin hesitantly following. The light outside was dimming as sunset neared. Setting the war palace up high like this was tactically sound, but it meant the place was mercilessly buffeted by storms. That was an old campaign conundrum. Did one choose the best position to weather storms, or did one seize the high ground? Most would have chosen the former. Their war camps on the edge of the shattered plains were unlikely to be attacked, making the advantage of the high ground less important. But kings tended to prefer height. In this instance, Dalinar had encouraged Elokar just in case. The balcony itself was a thick platform of rock, cut onto the top of the small peak, edged with an iron railing. The king's rooms were a soul-cast dome sitting atop the natural formation, with covered ramps and stairways leading to tiers lower on the hillside. Those housed the king's various attendants, guards, storm wardens, ardents, and distant family members. Dalinar had his own bunker at his war camp. He refused to call it a palace. The king leaned against the railing, two guards watching from a distance. Dalinar motioned for Renarin to join them so that he could speak with the king in private. The air was cool, spring having come for a time, and it was sweet with the sense of evening, blooming rock buds and wet stone. Below, the war camps were starting to come alight, 10 sparkling circles filled with watchfires, cookfires, lamps, and the steady glow of infused gems. Elokar stared over the camps and toward the shattered plains. They were utterly dark, save for the occasional twinkle of a watchpost. "Do they watch us from out there?" Elokar asked as Dalinar joined him. "We know their raiding bands move at night, Your Majesty," Dalinar said, resting one hand on the iron railing. "I can't help but think they watch us." The king's uniform had the traditional long coat with buttons up the sides, but it was loose and relaxed, and ruffled lace poked out of the collar and cuffs. His trousers were solid blue and were cut in the same baggy fashion as Ruthar's. It all looked so informal to Dalinar. Increasingly, their soldiers were being led by a slack group who dressed in lace and spent their evenings at feasts. "This is what Gavilar foresaw," Dalinar thought. "This is why he grew so insistent that we follow the codes."
"You look thoughtful, Uncle," Elokar said.
"Just considering the past, Your Majesty."
"The past is irrelevant. I only look forward."
Dalinar was not certain he agreed with either statement.
"I sometimes think I should be able to see the Parshendi," Elokar said. "I feel that if I stare long enough, I will find them, pin them down so I can challenge them. I wish they'd just fight me like men of honor."
"If they were men of honor," Dalinar said, clasping his hands behind his back, "then they would not have killed your father as they did."
"Why did they do it, do you suppose?"
Dalinar shook his head. "That question has churned in my head over and over like a boulder tumbling down a hill. Did we offend their honor? Was it some cultural misunderstanding?"
"A cultural misunderstanding would imply that they have a culture. Primitive brutes. Who knows why a horse kicks or an axe hound bites? I shouldn't have asked."
Dalinar didn't reply. He'd felt that same disdain, that same anger, in the months following Gavilar's assassination. He could understand Elokar's desire to dismiss these strange wildland parshmen as little more than animals. But he'd seen them during those early days, interacted with them. They were primitive, yes, but not brutes, not stupid. We never really understood them, he thought. I guess that's the crux of the problem. Elokar, he said softly, it may be time to ask ourselves some difficult questions.
Such as?
Such as how long will we continue this war? Elokar started. He turned, looking at Dalinar.
We'll keep fighting until the Vengeance Pact is satisfied and my father is avenged.
Noble words, Dalinar said. But we've been away from Alethkar for 6 years now. Maintaining 2 far-flung centers of government is not healthy for the kingdom.
Kings often go to war for extended periods, uncle.
Rarely do they do it for so long, Dalinar said. And rarely do they bring every shard-bearer and high prince in the kingdom with them. Our resources are strained, and word from home is that the Reshi border encroachments grow increasingly bold. We are still fragmented as a people, slow to trust one another, and the nature of this extended war, without a clear path to victory, and with a focus on riches rather than capturing ground, is not helping at all. Elokar sniffed, wind blowing at them atop the peaked rock.
You say there's no clear path to victory? We've been winning. The Parshendi raids are coming less frequently and aren't striking as far westward as they once did. We've killed thousands of them in battle.
Not enough, Dalinar said. They still come in strength. The siege is straining us as much as, or more than, it is them.
Weren't you the one to suggest this tactic in the first place?
I was a different man then, flush with grief and anger.
And you no longer feel those things?
Elokar was incredulous.
Uncle, I can't believe I'm hearing this. You aren't seriously suggesting that I abandon the war, are you? You'd have me slink home like a scolded axe hound?
I said they were difficult questions, Your Majesty, Dalinar said, keeping his anger in check. It was taxing. But they must be considered. Elokar breathed out, annoyed.
It's true what Sadius and the others whisper. You're changing, Uncle. It has something to do with those episodes of yours, doesn't it?
They are unimportant, Elokar. Listen to me. What are we willing to give in order to get vengeance?
Anything.
And if that means everything your father worked for? Do we honor his memory by undermining his vision for Alethkar, all to get revenge in his name? The king hesitated.
You pursue the Parshendi, Dalinar said. That is laudable. But you can't let your passion for just retribution blind you to the needs of our kingdom. The Vengeance Pact has kept the High Princes channeled, but what will happen once we win? Will we shatter? I think we need to forge them together, to unite them. We fight this war as if we were 10 different nations fighting beside one another, but not with one another.
The king didn't respond immediately. The words, finally, seemed to be sinking in. He was a good man and shared more with his father than others chose to admit. He turned away from Dalinar, leaning against the railing.
You think I'm a poor king, don't you, uncle?
What?
Of course not. You always talk about what I should be doing and where I am lacking. Tell me truthfully, uncle. When you look at me, do you wish you saw my father's face instead?
Of course I do, Dalinar said. Elokar's expression darkened. Dalinar laid a hand on his nephew's shoulder. I'd be a poor brother if I didn't wish that Gavilar had lived. I failed him. It was the great, most terrible failure of my life.
Elokar turned to him, a
and Dalinar held his gaze, raising a finger.
But just because I loved your father does not mean that I think you are a failure. Nor does it mean I do not love you in your own right. Alethkar itself could have collapsed upon Gavilar's death, but you organized and executed our counterattack. You are a fine king.
The king nodded slowly.
You've been listening to readings from that book again, haven't you?
I have.
You sound like him, you know,
Elokar said, turning back to look eastward again.
Near the end, when he began to act erratically.
Surely I'm not so bad as that.
Perhaps. But this is much like how he was, talking about an end to war, fascinated by the Lost Radiance, insisting everyone follow the codes.
Dalinar remembered those days, and his own arguments with Gavilar. What honor can we find on a battlefield while our people starve? The king had once asked him. Is it honor when our light eyes plot and scheme like eels in a bucket, slithering over one another and trying to bite each other's tails? Dalinar had reacted poorly to his words, just as Elokar was reacting to his words now.
Stormfather, I am starting to sound like him, aren't I?
That was troubling, yet somehow encouraging at the same time. Either way, Dalinar realized something. Adolin was right. Elokar, and the High Princes with him, would never respond to a suggestion that they retreat. Dalinar was approaching the conversation in the wrong way.
Almighty be blessed for sending me a son willing to speak his mind.
Perhaps you are right, Your Majesty, Dalinar said. End the war? Leave a battlefield with an enemy still in control? That would shame us.
Elokar nodded in agreement.
I'm glad you see sense. But something does have to change. We need a better way to fight. Sadeas has a better way already. I spoke of his bridges to you. They work so well, and he's captured so many gem hearts.
Gem hearts are meaningless, Dalinar said. All of this is meaningless if we won't find a way to get the vengeance we all want. You can't tell me you enjoy watching the High Princes squabble, practically ignoring our real purpose in being here.
Elokar fell silent, looking displeased.
Unite them.
He remembered those words booming in his head.
Elokar, he said, an idea occurring to him. Do you remember what Sadeas and I spoke of to you when we first came here to war? The specialization of the High Princes?
Yes, Elokar said. In the distant past, each of the 10 High Princes in Alethkar had been given a specific charge for the governing of the kingdom. One had been the ultimate law in regard to merchants, and his troops had patrolled the roadways of all 10 princedoms. Another had administered judges and magistrates. Gavilar had been very taken by the idea. He claimed it was a clever device meant to force the High Princes to work together. Once, this system had forced them to submit to one another's authority. Things hadn't been done that way in centuries, ever since the fragmenting of Alethkar into 10 autonomous princedoms.
Elokar, what if you named me High Prince of War?
Dalinar asked. Elokar didn't laugh. That was a good sign.
I thought you and Sadeas decided that the others would revolt if we tried something like that.
Perhaps I was wrong about that, too.
Elokar appeared to consider it. Finally, the king shook his head.
No. They barely accept my leadership. If I did something like this, they'd assassinate me.
I'd protect you.
Bah! You don't even take the present threats on my life seriously.
Dalinar sighed.
Your Majesty, I do take threats to your life seriously. My scribes and attendants are looking into the strap.
And what have they discovered?
Well, so far we have nothing conclusive. Nobody has taken credit for trying to kill you, even in rumor. Nobody saw anything suspicious. But Adolin is speaking with leather workers. Perhaps he'll bring something more substantial.
It was cut, Uncle.
We will see.
You don't believe me, Elokar said, face growing red. You should be trying to find out what the assassin's plan was rather than pestering me with some arrogant quest to become overlord of the entire army.
Dalinar gritted his teeth.
I do this for you, Elokar.
Elokar met his eyes for a moment, and his blue eyes flashed with suspicion again, as they had the week before.
Blood of my fathers, Dalinar thought. He's getting worse.
Elokar's expression softened a moment later, and he seemed to relax. Whatever he'd seen in Dalinar's eyes had comforted him.
I know you try for the best, Uncle, Elokar said, but you have to admit that you've been erratic lately. The way you react to storms, your infatuation with my father's last words.
I'm trying to understand him.
He grew weak at the end, Elokar said. Everyone knows it. I won't repeat his mistakes, and you should avoid them as well. Rather than listening to a book that claims that light eyes should be the slaves of the dark eyes.
That's not what it says, Dalinar said. It has been misinterpreted. It's mostly just a collection of stories which teach that a leader should serve those he leads.
Bah! It was written by the Lost Radiance.
They didn't write it. It was their inspiration. Noadan, an ordinary man, was its author.
Elokar glanced at him, raising an eyebrow.
See, it seemed to say, you defend it.
You are growing weak, Uncle. I will not exploit that weakness, but others will.
I am not getting weak.
Yet again, Dalinar forced himself to be calm. This conversation has gone off the path. The High Princes need a single leader to force them to work together. I vow that if you name me High Prince of War, I will see you protected.
As you saw my father protected.
Dalinar's mouth snapped shut. Elokar turned away. I should not have said that. It was uncalled for.
No, Dalinar said. No, it was one of the truest things you have said to me, Elokar. Perhaps you are right to distrust my protection.
Elokar glanced at him, curious.
Why do you react that way?
What way?
Once, if someone had said that to you, you'd have summoned your blade and demanded a duel. Now you agree with them instead. My father started refusing duels near the end.
Elokar tapped on the railing.
I see why you feel the need for a High Prince of War, and you may have a point. But the others very much like the present arrangement.
Because it is comfortable to them. If we are going to win, we will need to upset them.
Dalinar stepped forward.
Elokar, maybe it's been long enough. 6 years ago, naming a High Prince of War might well have been a mistake. But now? We know one another better, and we've been working united against the Parshendi. Perhaps it is time to take the next step.
Perhaps, the king said. You think they are ready? I'll let you prove it to me. If you can show me that they are willing to work with you, Uncle, then I'll consider naming you High Prince of War. Is that satisfactory?
It was a solid compromise. Very well.
Good, the king said, standing up. Then let us part for now. It is growing late, and I have yet to hear what Ruthar wishes of me.
Dalinar nodded his farewell, walking back through the king's chambers, Renarin trailing him. The more he considered, the more he felt that this was the right thing to do. Retreating would not work with the Alethi, particularly not with their current mindset. But if he could shock them out of their complacency, force them to adopt a more aggressive strategy... He was still lost in thought, considering that, as they left the king's palace and made their way down the ramps to where their horses waited. He climbed astride Gallant, nodding his thanks to the groom who had cared for the Rashadium. The horse had recovered from his fall during the hunt, his leg solid and hale. It was a short distance back to Dalinar's war camp, and they rode in silence.
"Which of the High Princes should I approach first?" Dalinar thought. Sadius?
No.
Now he and Sadius were already seen working together too often. If the other High Princes began to smell a stronger alliance, it would drive them to turn against him. Best that he approach less powerful High Princes first, and see if he could get them to work with him in some way. A joint plateau assault, perhaps? He'd have to approach Sadius eventually. He didn't relish the thought. Things were always so much easier when the two of them could work at a safe distance from one another. He.
Father?
Renarin said. He sounded dismayed. Dalinar sat upright, looking around, hand going for his side sword even when he prepared to summon his shard blade. Renarin pointed. Eastward. Stormward. The horizon was growing dark.
Was there supposed to be a high storm today?
Dalinar asked, alarmed.
Elthabar said it was unlikely, Renarin said. But he's been wrong before.
Everyone could be wrong about high storms. They could be predicted, but it was never an exact science. Dalinar narrowed his eyes, heart thumping. Yes, he could sense the signs now. The dust picking up, the sense changing. It was evening, but there should still be more light left. Instead, it was rapidly growing darker and darker. The very air felt more frantic.
Should we go to Aladar's camp?
Renarin said, pointing. They were nearest High Prince Aladar's war camp, and perhaps only a quarter-hour ride from the rim of Dalinar's zone. Aladar's men would take him in. Nobody would forbid shelter to a High Prince during a storm. But Dalinar shuddered, thinking of spending a high storm trapped in an unfamiliar place, surrounded by another High Prince's attendants. They would see him during an episode. Once that happened, the rumors would spread like arrows above a battlefield.
We ride,
he called, kicking Gallant into motion. Renarin and the guardsmen fell in behind him, hooves a thunder to precurse the coming high storm. Dalinar leaned low, tense. The gray sky grew clotted with dust and leaves blown ahead of the storm wall, and the air grew dense with humid anticipation. The horizon burgeoned with thickening clouds. Dalinar and the others galloped past Aladar's perimeter guards, who bustled with activity, holding their coats or cloaks against the wind.
Father?
Renarin called from behind.
Are you?
We have time,
Dalinar shouted. They eventually reached the jagged wall of the Kolin war camp. Here, the remaining soldiers wore blue and white and saluted. Most had already retreated to their enclosures. He had to slow Gallant to get through the checkpoint. However, it would be just another short gallop to his quarters. He turned Gallant, preparing to go.
Father!
Renarin said, pointing eastward. The storm wall hung like a curtain in the air, speeding toward the camp. The massive sheet of rain was a silvery gray, the clouds above onyx black, lit from within by occasional flashes of lightning. The guards who had saluted him were hurrying to a nearby bunker.
We can make it,
Dalinar said. We...
Father!
Renarin said, riding up beside him and catching his arm.
I'm sorry.
The wind whipped at them, and Dalinar gritted his teeth, looking at his son. Renarin's spectacled eyes were wide with concern. Dalinar glanced at the storm wall again. It was only moments away.
He's right.
He handed Gallant's reins to an anxious soldier, who took the reins of Renarin's mount as well, and the two of them dismounted. The groom rushed away, towing the horses into a stone stable. Dalinar almost followed. There would be fewer people to watch him in a stable. But a nearby barrack had the door open, and those inside waved anxiously. That would be safer. Resigned, Dalinar joined Renarin, dashing to the stone-walled barrack. The soldiers made room for them. There was a group of servants packed inside as well. In Dalinar's camp, no one was forced to weather the tempests in storm tents or flimsy wooden shacks, and nobody had to pay for protection inside stone structures. The occupants seemed shocked to see their High Prince and his son step in. Several paled as the door thumped shut. Their only light was from a few garnets mounted on the walls. Someone coughed, and outside a scattering of wind-blown rock chips sprayed against the building. Dalinar tried to ignore the uncomfortable eyes around him. Wind howled outside. Perhaps nothing would happen. Perhaps this time, the storm hit. It began. XIX. Star Falls. He holds the most frightening and terrible of all of the shards. Ponder on that for a time, you old reptile, and tell me if your insistence on non-intervention holds firm. Because I assure you, race will not be similarly inhibited. Dalinar blinked. The stuffy, dimly lit barrack was gone. Instead, he stood in darkness. The air was thick with the scent of dried grain, and when he reached out with his left hand, he felt a wooden wall. He was in a barn of some sort. The cool night was still and crisp. There was no sign of a storm. He felt carefully at his side. His side sword was gone, as was his uniform. Instead, he wore a homespun belted tunic and a pair of sandals. It was the type of clothing he'd seen depicted on ancient statues.
Stormwinds, where have you sent me this time?
Each of his visions was different. This would be the 12th one he'd seen.
Only 12, he thought.
It seemed like so many more. But this had only begun happening to him a few months ago. Something moved in the darkness. He flinched in surprise as something living pressed against him. He nearly struck it, but froze when he heard it whimper. He carefully lowered his arm, feeling the figure's back. Slight and small, a child. She was quivering.
Father?
Her voice trembled.
Father, what is happening?
As usual, he was being seen as someone of this place and time. The girl clutched him, obviously terrified. It was too dark to see the fear-spren he suspected were climbing up through the ground. Dalinar rested his hand on her back.
Hush. It will be all right.
It seemed the right thing to say.
Mother?
She will be fine.
The girl huddled more closely against him in the black room. He remained still. Something felt wrong. The building creaked in the wind. It wasn't well built. The plank beneath Dalinar's hand was loose, and he was tempted to push it free so he could peek out. But the stillness, the terrified child, there was an oddly putrid scent in the air. Something scratched ever so softly at the barn's far wall, like a fingernail being drawn across a wooden tabletop. The girl whimpered, and the scraping sound stopped. Dalinar held his breath, heart beating furiously. Instinctively, he held his hand out to summon his shard blade, but nothing happened. It would never come during the visions. The far wall of the building exploded inward. Splintered wood flew through the darkness as a large shape burst in. Lit only by moon glow and starlight from outside, the black thing was bigger than an axe hound. He couldn't make out details, but it seemed to have an unnatural wrongness to its form. The girl screamed and Dalinar cursed, grabbing her with one arm and rolling to the side as the black thing leaped for them. It nearly got the child, but Dalinar whipped her out of the creature's path. Breathless with terror, her scream cut off. Dalinar spun, pushing the girl behind him. His side hit a stack of sacks filled with grain as he edged away. The barn fell silent. Salus's violet light shone in the sky outside, but the small moon wasn't bright enough to illuminate the barn's interior, and the creature had moved into a shadowed recess. He couldn't see much of it. It seemed part of the shadows. Dalinar tensed, fists forward. It made a soft, wheezing sound, eerie and faintly reminiscent of rhythmic whispering.
Breathing?
Dalinar thought.
No. It's sniffing for us.
The thing darted forward. Dalinar whipped a hand to the side and grabbed one of the grain sacks, pulling it in front of himself. The beast struck the sack, its teeth ripping into it, and Dalinar pulled, tearing the coarse fabric and flinging a fragrant cloud of dusty lapis grain into the air. Then he stepped to the side and kicked the beast as hard as he could. The creature felt too soft under his foot, as if he'd kicked a water skin. The blow knocked it to the ground, and it made a hissing sound. Dalinar flung the bag and its remaining contents upward, filling the air with more dry lapis and dust. The beast scrambled to its feet and twisted around, smooth skin reflecting moonlight. It seemed disoriented. Whatever it was, it hunted by smell, and the dust in the air confused it. Dalinar grabbed the girl and threw her over his shoulder, then dashed past the confused creature, barreling through the hole in the broken wall. He burst out into violet moonlight. He was in a small late, a wide rift in the stone with good enough drainage to avoid flooding, and a high stone outcropping to break the high storms. In this case, the eastern rock formation was shaped like an enormous wave, creating shelter for a small village. That explained the flimsiness of the barn. Lights flickered here and there across the hollow, indicating a settlement of several dozen homes. He was on the outskirts. There was a hog pen to Dalinar's right, distant homes to his left, and, just ahead, nestled against the rock hill, was a mid-sized farmhouse. It was built in an archaic style, with creme bricks for walls. His decision was easy. The thing had moved quickly like a predator. Dalinar wouldn't outrun it, so he charged toward the farmhouse. The sound of the beast breaking out through the barn wall came from behind. Dalinar reached the home, but the front door was barred. Dalinar cursed loudly, pounding on it. Claws scraped on stone from behind as the thing bounded toward them. Dalinar threw his shoulder against the door just as it opened. He stumbled inside, dropping the girl to the floor as he found his balance. A middle-aged woman stood inside. Violet moonlight revealed that she had thick, curly hair and a wide-eyed, terrified expression. She slammed the door closed behind him, then barred it.
"Praise the heralds," she exclaimed, scooping up the girl. "You found her, Heb. Bless you."
Dalinar sidled up to the glassless window looking out. The shutter appeared to be broken loose, making the window impossible to latch closed. He couldn't see the creature. He glanced back over his shoulder. The building's floor was simple stone, and there was no second story. A fireless brick hearth was set on one side, with a rough-cast iron pot hanging above it. It all looked so primitive. What year was this? It's just a vision, he thought. A waking dream. Why did it feel so real then? He looked back out the window. It was silent outside. A twin row of rock buds grew on the right side of the yard, probably turnips or some other kind of vegetable. Moonlight reflected off the smooth ground. Where was the creature? Had it? Something slick-skinned and black leapt up from below and crashed against the window. It shattered the frame, and Dalinar cursed, falling as the thing landed on him. Something sharp slashed his face, cutting open his cheek, spilling blood across his skin. The girl screamed again.
"Light!" Dalinar bellowed. "Get me light!"
He slammed his fist into the side of the creature's too soft head, using his other arm to push back a clawed paw. His cheek burned with pain, and something raked his side, slashing his tunic and cutting his skin. With a heave, he threw the creature off him. It crashed against the wall, and he rolled to his feet, gasping. As the beast righted itself in the dark room, Dalinar scrambled away, old instincts kicking in, pain evaporating as the battle thrill surged through him. He needed a weapon, a stool or a table leg. The room was so... Light flickered on as the woman uncovered a lit pottery lamp. The primitive thing used oil, not stormlight, but was more than enough to illuminate her terrified face and the girl clinging to her robe-like dress. The room had a low table and a pair of stools, but his eyes were drawn to the small hearth. There, gleaming like one of the honor blades of ancient lore, was a simple iron fire poker. It leaned against the stone hearth, tip white with ash. Dalinar lunged forward, snatching it in one hand, twirling it to feel out its balance. He had been trained in classical wind stance, but he fell into smoke stance instead, as it was better with an imperfect weapon. 1 foot forward, 1 foot behind, sword, or in this case poker, held forward with the tip toward his opponent's heart. Only years of training allowed him to maintain his stance as he saw what was facing him. The creature's smooth, dark-as-midnight skin reflected light like a pool of tar. It had no visible eyes, and its black, knife-like teeth bristled in a head set on a sinuous, boneless neck. The six legs were slender and bent at the sides, appearing far too thin to bear the weight of the fluid, ink-like body.
"This isn't a vision," Dalinar thought. "It's a nightmare."
The creature raised its head, clicking teeth together, and made a hissing sound, tasting the air.
"Sweet wisdom of Batar," the woman breathed, holding her child close.
Her hands shook as she held up the lamp, as if to use it as a weapon. A scraping came from outside, and was followed by another set of spindly legs slinking over the lip of the broken window. This new beast climbed into the room, joining its companion, which crouched anxiously, sniffing at Dalinar. It seemed wary, as if it could sense that it faced an armed, or at least determined, opponent. Dalinar cursed himself for a fool, raising one hand to his side to staunch the blood. He knew logically that he was really back in the barrack with Renarin. This was all happening in his mind. There was no need for him to fight. But every instinct, every shred of honor he had, drove him to step to the side, placing himself between the woman and the beasts. Vision, memory, or delusion, he could not stand aside.
"Heb,"
the woman said, her voice nervous. Who did she see him as? Her husband? A farmhand?
"Don't be a fool. You don't know how..."
The beasts attacked. Dalinar leapt forward. Remaining in motion was the essence of smoke stance, and spun between the creatures, striking to the side with his poker. He hit the one on the left, ripping a gash in its too smooth skin. The wound bled smoke. Moving behind the creatures, Dalinar swung again, swinging low at the feet of the unwounded beast, knocking it off balance. With the follow-through, he slammed the side of the poker into the face of the wounded beast as it turned and snapped at him.